And it's just like really weird and a manifestation of the patriarchy's ego to be like, oh no, all the suffering of these teenage girls is because we, two men, made a fatal mistake.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanty Show's Screen Scouts.
And welcome to Egg World!
Yay! Egg World! It's nice in here. We all float.
I want them over easy.
I'm Sean.
I'm Brandon.
I'm Iori.
And on today's show, we're joined by writer and game designer Joshua Kim. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Hello, hello. Thank you for having me. I'm sad that you took out the part, Brandon, where it said I was a hermit. That's very important to my identity.
Yes, that was very important, but you are present among other people, so that kind of diminishes your hermitage.
But we could add that in. So instead, on today's show, we're joined by hermit freelance writer and game designer Joshua Kim.
Welcome to the show.
Yes.
Awesome. So today we're going to be discussing Wonder Egg Priority, which is the one of two anime options that Brandon gave me in his effort to secretly turn this show into an anime show, which is very possible.
Mm-hmm.
It's produced by Cloverworks Studio and is written by Shinji Nojima, directed by Shin Wakabayashi, which I hope I got correct. Voice actors include Kanada Aikawa, Tomori Kusunoki, Shuka Saito, and Hinaki Yano, among others. There are also English dubs, but I'm not going to read all of their names because that I just can't. There's just 40,000 billion names that I could say. So if you're in the U.S., it is available on Funimation. You can watch it for free with advertisements. I would recommend just getting the free trial and then paying $8 a month because I got literally the same Peloton advertisement 47 times per episode. And if I hear a Peloton ad again, I will lose my damn mind.
Okay, I'm not sure if I'm jealous of you because I can't get Funimation in Trinidad, or if I'm pleased that I didn't get dozens of Peloton ads.
Well, let me put it to you this way. I didn't even get 5 minutes into the first episode before I just said, screw it, I'm just signing up.
Duly noted. So before we get into the rest of this beautiful conversation, a friendly reminder that we want to hear from you. Share your comments with us about this and past episodes at skiffyandfanty.com/listener-suggestions. We want to put together a listener mailbag episode at some point, so your thoughts, questions, topic suggestions, and more would be very useful. So get those thoughts in.
Yep, and I would very much like, if anyone's watching the show and also listening, explain the ending. We'll get to that, I'm sure, but I want you to explain the ending.
The ending.
Quote-unquote.
Awesome. Okay, well, let's get to it. Who would like to volunteer themselves to summarize this? Apparently, Ari is raising a hand, so I'm going to give it to you.
Actually, I was going to start with, we should clarify, it's not over yet. At the point we've recorded, 12 out of 13 episodes have been released. The
right,
13th
yes.
episode is not supposed to drop until the 29th of June. So technically, right now, we are reviewing an incomplete work.
I mean, technically, 12 out of 12 episodes are out. A 13th one is just on the way, as it turns out.
Tomato, tomato.
If you're actually interested, and I've linked Brandon to this, I've told Brandon about this, but the reason that there appears to be a 13th episode in the works is due to a production meltdown at the team that was actually working on One Drag Priority. It's kind of one of those things that shows you how fragile the industry itself is, but they were not planning on a 13th episode. Normally, those are the kinds of things that, like, people plan on way far in advance, but they had to very quickly do a recap episode because they just couldn't keep up with the production.
Yeah.
Yeah, episode 8 was not supposed to look the way it does at all. For our viewers who haven't seen Wonder Egg Priority, episode 8 was a clip show. We just got two of the voice actors in and had them narrate over existing footage, which is just what happens when you run out of time and money.
The dreaded recap episode.
Oh,
I will just say, for me, it was enormously helpful as a recap, because I was like, oh man, this is a weird show. And then I got to that episode and I was like, wait, they're going to explain so much to me. Thank you. This is very useful. I didn't think it needed to be 23 minutes long, but you know.
Oh yeah, definitely not. like, for the purposes of gaining information, it could have been 16 minutes. And then we could have gotten some action, some drama would have been useful, but yes.
Right.
Yeah.
I think Brandon should summarize the series for us, but not before we warn our viewers that Wonder Egg Priority has a trigger warnings list longer than some of my short stories.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep.
So, in particular, the entire gist of the show deals very heavily with teenage suicide. So, while we're trying to be as respectful as possible during the discourse, if anything that we say becomes very troubling for you, take your time with this episode, and definitely take your time with the anime itself, because it gets very hard at times. It deals with teenage suicide, it deals with sexual assault, it deals with transphobia in large doses and very respectfully, but very irreverently as well. So yes. With that being said, Wonder Egg Priority is about a teenage girl named Ai who is struggling with a lot of things and as a result has not been to school in several days. Like, while being pestered by her mother to go back to school or at least take some art tutoring from her art teacher, she decides to take a walk one afternoon and discovers a vending machine that sells eggs and is told by the person who brought her to this vending machine that sells eggs, which was disguised, like, that the person who guided her to that vending machine is disguised at that moment as a firefly, yes. And the firefly tells her that when she goes to sleep, the egg will hatch, and then a cool thing will happen, and this one egg is free. So she takes the egg and goes home and, like, places it by her bed and goes to sleep, and then she wakes up in a haunted version of her own school where the egg hatches and a girl falls out. And she now has to save this girl from being tormented by little small demon things that are hunting them throughout the school. Because Ai has been very, like, meekly hinted that if she does this enough times, she may be able to bring her friend back from the dead. So she goes along with it and meets some friends along the way, and we discover even more traumatizing things about all of those girls, and it's a ride. For 7 episodes, and then the rest of the episodes become drastically more peculiar, which we will get to.
Oh, yeah. Those last few episodes, man, those were dark. Like, really dark.
Yeah, a lot of things happen all of a sudden. I mean, it's not like it's darker than what we've already seen. It's also a very bloody anime. First, like, you would imagine that its opening premise would be as bright and as cheerful as possible, but it ends up being both that and gratuitously bloody at all times, and it's actually a lot to behold.
So, yeah, an easy way to describe the vibe here is, like, put Madoka and Penguin Drum in a blender. And that's the vibe you have for the first 7 episodes, and then it escalates pretty abruptly. Sean, how many spoilers am I actually allowed to give on this show? I should have asked you that before we started.
Any spoiler from this point is open game. Past the summary, you can spoil anything you like.
Okay, fantastic. So, the first 7 episodes of this show were great. I thought we were actually going to talk about a lot of the social issues that Japan kind of just kicks into the closet and pretends that don't exist. And then after the worst and weirdest house party ever in episode 9, it all takes a turn.
That's putting it lightly. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like, okay, so to put into context, a lot of the show at this point is operating under, like, very surreal rules. We don't need to ask questions about why a firefly instructed you to buy an egg and go to sleep with it. We don't need to ask questions about coming to the house where the vending machine was made and discovering 2 cloth adult bodies playing chess at a table outside. We don't need to ask questions about why they're eggs or how the eggs are made. And then, past episode 8, everything is about answering questions, and all of the answers are dark and weird and bad.
And none of them follow logically from anything we just saw.
Oh, God.
Right?
Yeah.
Because at this point, we're just following girls who are having this somewhat surreal transcendent experience that will not only help them realize more about their own traumas and the traumas of other teenage girls in their area, that they're doing it because they just want to bring loved ones back from the dead. A question that the show still doesn't sufficiently answer whether they succeeded or not. But then we learn maybe these teenagers didn't just have traumas that they had to deal with, but maybe parallel worlds exist, and maybe two scientists accidentally made an AI that can travel across those parallel worlds for no other reason than to just hurt and drive to suicide teenage girls that will remind these two scientists of her. It's like, what?
I'm really angry about the thrill reveal where this shadowy AI villain is driving people to suicide, because I feel that that takes agency away from the other characters. It undercuts the premise of the first 7 episodes, where we were going to look at the social problems that cause as people to feel suicide may be necessary for them. We could have actually started looking at, maybe we need to fix society. No. We have a clear villain. Therefore, society's okay. The status quo's just fine. We only need to worry about this one villain.
It's actually embarrassingly hollow as a shift in perspective, because we go from discovering that these other girls who the protagonists have only met in this world are suffering from feelings of imposter syndrome and sexual harassment at school from adults, and like serious like gender dysphoria and all of these other complicated things that when we witness those things in that world are asking questions about the things that we ignore when teenagers experience them, and especially when teenage girls experience them, and how that puts pressure on those teenagers to have to continue bearing that until they break. And then we learn, oh, it's this thing called the temptation of death that is just drawing teenagers to hurt themselves for no real reason. But they were still experiencing things here. We saw them experience those things. Those things did not exist because there's a villain. And like, that kind of dissonance is really meaningless. It doesn't reinforce anything. It makes the last 7 episodes feel like they were just literally a video game that these characters were playing.
Yeah.
And it's just like really weird and a manifestation of the patriarchy's ego to be like, oh no, all the suffering of these teenage girls is because we, two men, made a fatal mistake. The fuck?
I think one of the most upsetting things to me about like the progression of Wonder Egg Priority is that the first like 7 episodes, you know, like you said, are like this really amazing tour de force about like, you know, the problems of society kind of burdening young women and how they are essentially, you know, abused as like a class of people, right? And it's really interesting because the structure of Wonder Egg Priority after the first episode is you kind of realize it's actually a magical girl show. And that's such a useful, interesting lens to look at, you know, the role of women and like especially young girls in society, especially in Japanese society, right? There's a lot of discourse about what it means to be a magical girl, what it means for that, what has traditionally been like, this is a female role model, like this is how you're supposed to act, and has kind of in, you know, more recent decades been explored as a way of exploring what it means to be like, you know, a young woman, especially one who has not grown into an adult. Right. And so Wonder Egg Priority is very effective at using that premise to build this like drama where we are legitimately tackling very uncomfortable issues that people don't usually want to talk about. Right. Like we're talking directly about suicide and why people commit suicide. We're talking about sexual assault, suicidal ideation. And in later episodes, we even talk about things like, you know, gender dysphoria and like the trans experience. And I think that's really interesting and valuable. Right up until the moment where the show decides it doesn't really want to be about that anymore. That pivot actually reminds me a lot of, I don't know if you've ever read or watch anything by Mado Nozaki. He's the writer for two novel series, Babylon and Seikai Tsurukado, which is like the cube anime.
I'm so yeah. glad you brought up Babylon, because I was about to. Yeah. Because if we want to talk about shadowy villain causing people to kill themselves, Babylon did it first, and not necessarily better, but it didn't make the same promises that Wonder Egg Priority did and failed to deliver on them.
Yeah, I think it's really important that, like, one thing I'm hearing is, like, this show promises X, and then once we get kind of past the recap episode, it sort of imagines itself as fulfilling some other promise it hadn't made to us at all. And while the ideas I thought that come after that point were interesting, the fact that some of them are clearly so integral to the entire plot but are set up in no significant way, or I would argue in some cases, not set up at all, creates huge problems. Because I think if you want to do this story where you have Frill, who is this sort of artificial intelligent young girl who is like brought up into the world and is dealing with like issues of rejection, and also she's like, I guess, sort of kind of evil because she's an AI thing, object, whatever she is, you have to set it up.
I think they were trying to give her blue and gray morality, right? Where it's just yeah. like, oh yes, Frill's an AI. She doesn't understand people have feelings. She's just operating off a completely different system.
Yeah.
I think to me, I would agree with you where I think the ideas in the abstract are fine, but they don't follow progression-wise from what the rest of the show has been. Because I think it would be very interesting to have a Magical Girl series about Warriors of Eros or whatever, right? Like this idea mm-hmm. of adolescence as kind of movers of the world, right? Of people who feel things very strongly and are prone to volatile emotion, and the value of that versus this kind of like apathetic like temptation of death. I like that structure, but I don't like it attached to what has already like been established. It's like they had to commit one way or another to like which show it wanted to be, and it just didn't.
And part of the problem, I think, with this, for me, was these first seven episodes in particular, the way that narrative is progressing gives us this strong impression that whether or not the people that they love are really actually going to come back to life, by going through this, discovering friends, and go through this process, they will have dealt with their grief and their feelings and all of the things that have affected them. But once we get to that huge switch, that goes right out the door. And it becomes, for me, a real problem because it almost feels cruel when we have that switch. The first time one of the little animals was killed, I almost stopped that episode. And I was like, but I have to finish the rest because we're doing this today. But, I mean, that was so shocking to me that had happened. And I was like, well, where does this go from this point? Because it's so violent. You've taken this moment where these characters have clearly... We see character progression. The characters grow and change over these episodes. And then all that is, like, destroyed in an instant. To me, if you're going to do that story, it has to be developed throughout from start to finish. There need to be clues to that leading us to this story rather than having it be a shocking switch. It feels like a cheap Game of Thrones trick in a way, which is Game of Thrones has done many a times where it's like, we're just going to kill someone because we need a shock. We need people to quote unquote feel something without necessarily thinking about how it's anchored to a story or to the character's development.
There is a promise of healing in the first few episodes that just gets completely thrown out after episode 8. And episodes 9 through 12 would have been a badass ending for a different show, one that had actually set any of this up and done that work. But instead, these switch into like sudden hard fantasy trauma, like violent fantasy trauma versus real world society induced trauma, felt actually really exploitative to me, because we had promised originally, yes, we're going to actually discuss the root causes of real pain. And instead, oh, the root cause of real pain is that two guys made an AI.
Yeah.
And one of the things that actually like stands out to me about that observation, Iori, is it's not even that the ending is like necessarily bad in context here as well, but it means that we would have also deserved something else that they never write any of the protagonists doing, which is acknowledging that they are being used at this point. Like, a part of me is fine with observing, hey, two adults just fooled four teenage girls into doing a thing. Because that's what we're learning, is the experience of being a teenager from the last 7 episodes anyway. But when they learn this, the writers never give them an opportunity to be upset, to say that they no longer want to do it, or to, like, have complicated feelings about the fact that this is still potentially giving them something that they want. They literally are about to have that argument when they discover, wait, no, we need to have a girl's talk moment about our friend going on a date. And then it never comes up again. And then they learn that their lives are in actual peril. And I just walks back home after learning that information. Nobody's mad about this. I don't, like...
There's a fundamental lack of respect for the character's agency.
Yeah, and it undermines all of the growth that those characters have had, because it just goes out the window immediately. And you're right, I would agree with you, Ori, that it undermines their agency even in that moment, right, when they're literally about to challenge them, and then they get, like, a text message, like, I went on a date, and it's like, oh, out the window. But it's like, you've been manipulated by these two, like, mannequin dudes who are up to something that could be nefarious. And we're not going to have a moment of, like, usually, I remember being a teenager, if I found out a bunch of adults were manipulating me into, going into a secret egg world and, like, fighting monsters, and it was for some other thing other than dealing with my own issues, I would be fucking furious. And yet, that just out the window.
The thing to me about the, like, progression and the character development is, like, the show is about trauma, and it's about... largely speaking, addressing and you know, like you said earlier, healing from trauma. And it's kind of, like, very confusing to me that the show is like, okay, here is the characters, like the main four girls, dealing with their trauma, you know, and now they're all traumatized by death, right? It's like, it feels like a, here we go, and then some more. And I would be interested to know, like, what the writing process of this show was, because if they were intending this all along, or not, right? It would be an interesting insight into how the anime was produced. I don't think it would make it any better if they had planned it from the beginning, because like we said, it's a complete disregard for the agency of the characters, which I think is really disappointing, especially because if you look into the, like, background of how the show was produced, it seems like they gave the characters a great deal of importance. They made very specific decisions. They were working with a small team, and they made decisions about who got to direct which episodes, and they would tend to, when an episode was character-focused, they would use the same director for it, right? And, I mean, like, how do you go from that to, like, the end of the show comes and none of the characters have any, like, recourse to do anything. They have nowhere to go. They have nothing to do, right? All they're going to do is what the two adult men who have already fucked up a bunch of times, like, will tell them to do.
Yeah.
And also, as an extension to that, I hadn't even thought about this until Soup pointed it out to me when I started watching it, which is the writer of Wonder Egg Priority has never written an anime before this point.
He's done some Getsukus, though, right?
Yeah, he's done a lot of dramas. He's done a lot of live-action dramas. Very restrained, emotionally competent stuff. But this is the first anime that he's done. And I feel like, at least for me, when I learned that information, I was like, so I'm expecting, even though we're playing in this surreal space, that a lot of the meat that we're supposed to get from this is, we're supposed to see these teenage girls deal with their feelings in complicated and exaggerated ways, but that the emotion is the point. And then we pivot hard into sci-fi, and I'm confused because this isn't even Shinji Nojima's realm. It just kind of comes up. And that also feels very weirdly like a production thing. Like, at some point when everything started falling apart, some committee member made the ultimate decision that if we're going to increase viewership, we need to, like, stop being about feelings and start being about something even more, like, violent and draw. And I was like, that's not what anybody came here for. I could just rewatch Jujutsu Kaisen if I wanted, like, unnecessary brutal violence. And even that still has feelings. That's... We're going to have to talk about Jujutsu Kaisen at some point. But still.
So I'm kind of wondering, like, is coming from dramas the reason why this isn't paced for shit?
There's something to that, I think. Because Wonder Egg definitely flubs the ending. And I will say, as far as an anime production goes, I do think that it was a success in some ways as an experiment. I've never seen an anime, at least I don't remember seeing an anime, that has been so well, like, directed. Like, the shot composition is always on point. But you're right, the pacing is a complete mess.
Like, he had it for the first few episodes, and then it just goes off the rails. And I'm wondering if that's a function of being used to writing to longer episodes, and sometimes for a longer run overall. Mm-hmm. Because I do think that around episode 10, they started Googling, okay, when's the next season? Because clearly, if you're introducing all these new elements, you know you're renewed. And there's going to be another 13 episodes or so to sort it all out. And instead I get, oh, it's not technically finished. They're going to put a button on it in June. And I'm just like, what? What? I'm sorry. How? If you think that one more episode is going to solve this, that episode is going to be doing a lot of work. And it's going to be like an hour and a half long.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I doubt that they were operating under the assumption that they were going to get more than, like, 12 episodes. It was obviously very unfortunate that they ran into production problems and had to go to 13. But even like, considering that, the pacing of the last couple episodes is just so weird, and it sets up, like, such a broad, open-ended, like, other thing that feels like it's kind of just tacked on at the end.
Because that setup sounds like the setup for either an entirely different anime or what you definitely call a movie.
Mm-hmm.
I has now been given an entirely separate mandate now, and has no problem fulfilling it. But that means that we stop watching Wonder Egg Priority and start watching Warrior of Eros or something.
Right.
Because that's what it's set up to do. Now we care about Frill and these, like, dragonfly aid things that just feed giant animal meat to teenage girls without their consent.
That was horrifying.
That was so upsetting.
It's very upsetting, and I'm very sorry to do that to you all.
I don't think I've ever seen a scene in anime that has unnerved me legitimately like that scene has.
And it says a lot that in an anime that is already very heavy, that's like, they just decided, okay, teenagers are experiencing real world trauma. How do we make that worse for teenagers? Which is a lot in general. And I feel like one of the other reasons why I guess a lot of that really bothers me is we went from actually really caring about how teenagers think and feel, even if that means they have to experience that trauma alive for us to witness how they deal with it, to why don't we just put them in a situation where they can't deal with it and show you not them to you now not dealing with it in incredibly troubling ways? Like, Momoe has a breakdown, but that experience didn't need to happen. It's not real. Like, it's not something that we had to witness. So it feels at that point that we're witnessing this girl's trauma for witnessing trauma's sake, when it hadn't felt like that before.
I would even say that, like, the big twist recasts a lot of the earlier trauma for me now as being just gratuitous suffering porn. And it's kind of worse because the actual animation of this show is gorgeous. They really gave their key animators a lot of leeway to decide some beautiful shots. And now, in hindsight, I'm just super creeped out by all these gorgeous shots of girls crying. It's like, oh, God, here we go again, because there's this extremely gross thing in Japanese culture where a lot of men feel that a woman is most beautiful or hottest when she is crying. This is 1,000 years old. This literally goes all the way back to the tale of Genji, when the worst protagonist ever looks at a woman he made cry and goes, oh, she's in tears. That's so hot. I'm so hard right now. And
what?
That's just a cultural thing that a lot of people unfortunately still feel is real, that female pain is more valuable and beautiful to look at and aesthetically pleasing than, like, existing, being happy, thriving. It feels like fetishization of female pain in a way that made me super uncomfortable.
Yeah?
Yeah, I mean, 100% I agree, because I definitely gave the show a lot of, like, credit in the earlier episodes for how well it seemed to handle trauma without it being gratuitous. But when it's recharacterized in, like, that way in the last couple episodes, it does kind of feel like, I would agree, like, it does feel, it suddenly starts to feel gratuitous. It feels like, what was the point of this being here other than to titillate, or, you know, to be an experience for you to watch and be like, oh no, right?
The gratuitousness for me is especially embodied in the way that the creatures that they have, their little minions, or how they're off, because they're mostly, they're just killed brutally. And then not just that, they're not just killed brutally, then they're fed to the people, to these young women. And it becomes this incredibly shocking moment for the characters. But for us, it's like even more shocking because it comes out of nowhere. And it doesn't necessarily do anything other than to just traumatize the characters and sort of put them into into paralysis, right? They can't respond in any other way, right? Especially with Momoe, I believe, who had to experience the first time and has already dealt with a lot of trauma and now has had to deal with this horrific event in which everything has basically been taken away from her violently and horrifically, including her agency, right? She has no, like, and I think this is, for me, the agency thing is really important, because the beginning of this whole episode is these young women making a choice. They're given an option, and then they make a choice to do this, to be part of this thing. And at the end, those choices are taken from them. They're all just stripped away. And it's sort of like the only options they have now is they cut and run, or they be involved in this sort of bizarre, nefarious plot against Thanatos to become like the supreme writers of Eros thing. And it feels like we go from this moment of these young women discovering their agency to having everything taken towards the end. And that is going totally backwards. And I don't know how you write that with one more episode, which almost guaranteed is not going to be at least a 2-hour theatrical film, right? How do you write that and get us back to that point at which, at about episode 7, when we see these young women and they have discovered friendship, they've started to deal with their trauma, they've sort of, I mean, for Ai, right, she goes back to school. That's a huge deal at the end of an episode, that she finally decides to go back to school. She's ready for this. How do we get back to that moment? I mean, is the end of this show now just these young women are horrifically and endlessly traumatized, and that's the legacy that's left? That's horrifying for a show that begins with dealing with trauma.
One of the things that I think is also important to mention, like, in the midst of all of that, is one of the questions that comes up as a result of rushing towards this kind of hollow, brutal ending is that one of the pivotal parts for me of the protagonist's agency that is lost is each of them were doing this for a reason, and now they never even get to discover how to find that closure in the first place. Not just because they were lied to about the mission itself, but because the show just stops ultimately caring about what those drives were in the first place. One of the, like, big subplots that comes up very early in the series is that Ai is worried that her friend Koito-chan, who she's on this journey for in the first place, may have had a negative experience with their teacher, a man who has been in Ai's home every day since we begin the series. And we're led to ask, like, very complicated questions about him as a result. Can we trust him? Is he safe, or is he perhaps a predator? And then it just never comes up again. There are hints, I think, in that final episode that he may have potentially been actively hostile to Ai in a parallel universe, which is also very weird and strange and sudden and out of nowhere. But that's still an opportunity for us to ask that question again. And then Ai literally looks at this, like, large, giant, disembodied head of Professor Sawaki and says, "You are a representation of all of my doubts and suspicions." And I'm like, but this alternate universe version of you is here and is in actual suffering.
Yes, the other thing that really bothered me about that scene is I is not the most reliable narrator. We've seen this going through the series, but I felt like that particular statement, saying the monster is just a manifestation of her doubts and suspicions, is a way to inherently cast doubt on all the other monsters and all these other people who have suffered. It calls into question the accuracy of how they saw these people in their life and whether those people were abusers. And ooh, that felt real gross.
Yeah, it does. Because every single episode we get where we see one of the egg people come out, right, the monster that comes for them ultimately, the big monster, ultimately is some sort of like monstrous exaggerated version of the person that was their ultimate traumatizer, right? So it's like a gym teacher who was incredibly brutal to there's sections dealing with sexual assault and so on and so forth. There's all this stuff going on. And I think you're right that when we get to the end and we say, well, this is now like more of a metaphor instead of an exaggerated version of what is a real trauma, kind of undermines what the rest of the story was trying to show.
Yeah, I 100% agree, right? The thing to me about the eggs, like the Wonder Eggs, is they were always meant to be like these manifestations of like of larger social issues, but also very specific traumas to each of these like young girls. And one of the things that's the most disappointing to me is that specifically one of the Wonder Eggs, the one who can like see ghosts or whatever, right, is like her trauma relates to the fact that nobody like listens to her or believes her. And a lot of the like monsters, right, say those same things. It's like, who will they believe, right? Who will they believe? Will they believe me, an adult man, or you, a small child? And it's one of those things that like I just wish was handled better, because like I think it's a very useful framework for like looking at things. I think it's an amazing like metaphor to like look at something as like important and heavy as social trauma without making it, I mean, in a sense, like without making it gratuitous, right? The fact that you can have a layer of abstraction from it and like experience that trauma in a constructive way in a fantasized space, like that's what fiction is about, right? Fiction is about having these safe experiences, like, or these safer versions of experiences, even if they may be negative experiences, right? And like that is such a strong theme to me. And then it kind of, the show almost goes on to say like, actually none of that really matters. What really matters is the trauma of being afraid of dying, which is like, all right, cool. That's not what the rest of the show has been about, right?
So I feel like ultimately one of the things that we've come down on consistently during this discussion is the reason why this is so frustrating, at least to me, is that these are perhaps some of the best examples of a piece of media addressing teenage trauma that I've ever seen. And then it just stops being that. And there is a whole deeper conversation that can be had past that about why media feels like it needs to be, like, why it needs to enter these kind of hyperbolic spaces when giving especially young people an avenue to deal with their own, to witness their own trauma and like find closure through that witnessing in a safe and responsible way through media is often just enough, is more than what a lot of young people already get in the media that they consume. I would go so far as to say that if Wonder Egg Priority ended at episode 7, it would still be one of the greatest anime that we have ever seen. And it's the fact that it didn't, that we have all of these frustrations that are bigger than the joys that we had. And that means something.
Yes. I want to ask, what was everyone's narrative point of no return? Oh god, they're not going to be able to dig their way out of this one moment. For me, it was actually when Uraraka is doing the long flashback sequence explaining Frill. The scene where they are beating Frill and shoving her into the cellar was the point at which I was like, oh god, this feels super gratuitous. I want to be out of here now. What do you mean there's still going to be more?
Yeah, I was thinking about when you asked that question, I was like, what's the moment that they told, was it episode 8 that they told us, or 9, that we learned that the two mannequin dudes are definitely up to something else?
Yes, when they talked to the secretary.
That was the moment where I was like, you're now adding a new big plot element, and I know how many episodes are left. And I don't know how, because we already still have to get this other one, which is like they all are going to, quote unquote, get their friends back or their loved ones or whatever, right? And they're going to finish their journey. And then somehow in 3 episodes, we're supposed to also figure out what this thing is. That was the moment of like, there's no way. I mean, at the very least, I was hopeful that what we get would be at least some kind of resolution, but we don't even get a resolution, really. We just get a kind of... things are in an unusual spot, as it were.
For me, I would say the point of no return was like the instant they brought up the temptation of death, right? Where like the second that they started talking about like, well, there must be a reason all these young women are committing suicide that isn't just society. And I'm like, I don't know about this one, guys.
Yeah.
Yeah. Episode 9 was also the line for me, but much, much earlier. I'm a writer. Everyone in this room has experience with science fiction and fantasy writing and reading on some level. In episode 8, the very moment that we learn that Nehru's company has been like dedicating resources to like witnessing dreams, I was like, is this a non sequitur? Or is this going to matter to the story somewhat? And then when we see that they've actually been watching Nehru's dreams, I'm like, so are we saying that dreams are separate from where they're going, or they went there in their dreams? And then when they say that they've actually witnessed Nehru's trips to the egg world, I'm like, nope, we are entering that dreaded point where all surrealist work dies, the point where you answer mm-hmm. questions. This is not good. Like, it's any of our, like, any of the best work that we've ever read or watched where the opening premise lingers in this sense of dreaminess, this sense of lack of clarity regarding what are like the rules of the world. We stay in those spaces precisely because ultimately those rules don't matter. We're here to watch the journey through that experience and see what value it actually provides for the protagonists. The moment where you answer questions is the moment when you have to decide what matters about that world building. And One Egg Priority already lays out so much that we can't like qualify, like, okay, so we know that Aka and Uraaka are no longer in their mortal bodies, but it doesn't answer why they decided to be a firefly that one time. So we know that the entire experience of going to these parallel worlds is manufactured by Aka and Uraaka for some purpose, but it doesn't answer exactly how they physically made the egg. And that space between not answering all of those questions and answering all of the questions that they do answer in ways that are not satisfactory to the goals that we already set out to enjoy in the series, it's really like immersion breaking when all they needed to do was just never care about those questions because we already didn't.
Yeah, because it's so the thing about the first episode of One Drag Priority is it plays in this very like surrealist, like magical realism kind of space. And it does feel like a little bit weird, but it's supposed to feel weird, right? And you become accustomed to it very quickly. Right. This is the thing about, I guess, like, regardless of one's opinion on like Haruki Murakami. Right. That's the space that he plays in a lot. Right. And he refuses adamantly to answer questions in a satisfactory way because it would just ruin it. Right. Like, the problem is, like, when you're engaging in any fiction, but especially anime, you are willing to suspend your disbelief quite a great distance. When you start answering questions, you decrease the amount of like suspension of disbelief that you can accommodate, right? So the more questions you try to answer, the more you're writing yourself into a corner, which is like disappointing because like the show is already like full of this like really potentially very good symbolic meat, right? This imagery of like the egg as the child, right? And like what it means to be like this like egg and to have the shell of your egg break. And all of these kinds of things are very interesting to look at. But as soon as you start trying to explain things, you ruin it for me. I'm like, oh no, I can't, I'm out of it all of a sudden. Now my brain is working. I didn't want this.
And I have to say, like, it's not the late game twist that broke it for me. I've seen other work do, here's the late game twist that recontextualizes everything you knew very effectively. The problem is that they wanted this late game twist to apparently spin us off into an entire new plot that they just didn't have time for in their production schedule.
And right, so the two things that emerged in my brain as a fan of anime that has never done large-scale production for a piece of media ever is, why didn't they just do what other anime do and just make that thing a spin-off? That could have very well been any of the other Madoka properties that are not the one that everybody knows. And that would have been the way that they enjoyed this Eros versus Thanatos story, and they would have been fine.
I will say this. What I liked about Wonder Egg to start with was it felt like if Madoka had any like actual real point to make about anything.
Yes.
Like, listen, I will always say I love Madoka, and I think it's a very tightly written narrative, but it also doesn't stand for anything at all.
Thank you.
Like Urobuchi is very proficient at like playing in the space of just very well written suffering all the time, right? I feel similarly about the third Madoka movie that I do about the ending of Wonder Egg Priority, where it's bizarre when you decide that you want to undercut everything you've already established, because like Madoka the series is a series about like what it means to be an adolescent and like finding hope in the face of despair. Madoka the third movie is fuck your hope. I don't give a shit. Everything sucks all the time.
Yeah.
If you like Wonder Egg Priority, I would just say honestly, like anything by Kunihiko Ikuhara is just gonna serve you better. Like Penguin Drum, Sarazanmai.
Exactly.
Any of those is like, it's like the antithesis of what we've been complaining about, where it's like it has a concept, it explores that concept in symbolic ways without ever trying to answer questions that you don't need answered, right?
Yes, you want to go watch some kids actually face their trauma and deal with it and move on with their lives? Go watch Sarazanmai.
Oh, Sarazanmai, so good.
I was literally just gonna say, like, just watch the first 5-6 episodes of One Day Priority and then immediately pivot to Sarazanmai and you'll be fine.
I love that this issue of questions has come up, because like we kind of started, Yori had said this thing like, oh, it's about the promises of the show, and then this other element of the questions that it sets up, and then I think the show tries to answer some questions, but it does it very subtly instead of telling us directly. But then it doesn't ever get to the full resolution of those questions. But I have to say, I know we've been ripping the show quite a lot, and deservedly so, because it's got a lot of problems. Those first 6-7 episodes for me, I got very invested in those episodes.
Yes.
Because I really was interested in seeing how they were going to deal with the trauma, how they were going to explore these characters. I love seeing the characters literally changed over the course of several episodes, right? I becomes completely different from where she was at the very start of this. And I was really curious of where does this ultimately go? And, you know, there were questions being answered there of, like, the nature of trauma and suicide and the different ways and the people engage in these activities and the kinds of horrible things that happen and the way people process that. And I liked that it was exploring that without necessarily just telling us, like, yelling at us with a button saying, these are what we're supposed to get, but you're supposed to interpret this and think about how they are also interpreting it. And then it, you know, unfortunately, it kind of goes off the rails. And I just want the show that's the first half before the recap episode. I want that show completed.
Yes. I think, honestly, that's why we're taking this so personally. The first 7 episodes were so good and got us so invested. And then we got this.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. From a production standpoint, like from just looking at it as a piece of visual media, it looks gorgeous. It is very well written. I think that no show has impressed me with just like, because I know that there are a lot of action scenes, but really what impressed me about Wonder Egg Priority is the scenes where the characters are just talking, because they're directed in a way that a lot of anime are not. Right? It's actually interesting to watch the characters talk because, one, the writing actually has some substance to it, right? They're actually having conversations that seem to matter to the characters. And also they're written in a way that like teenage girls kind of are, like they're a little abrasive towards each other. They're not all nice all the time. But I think like what really got me is if you watch the first episode, there's this scene where the Wonder Egg girl, the first one, is like running from all of the monsters, and she grabs Ai and is like, we should go. And Ai doesn't say anything. She just gives her a look. And then she just kind of, like, there's a moment, there's a pause for, like, the characters to breathe. And then she's like, oh, I see, right? Few anime are confident about telling that story visually, telling that communication visually. And it happens a lot throughout the series where, like, when the girls are talking to each other, they have a cadence to the way they talk and the way they emote at each other that is very, very good. And it's clear that you can tell, like, probably because the director is so well versed in live action, that this is like one of the very important things to consider that a lot of anime doesn't really. You know, we've been talking a lot about like expectations and questions, and I think ultimately it comes down to what is important is to treat your work as something that has meaning and to address that meaning in a way that is satisfying, right? Wonder Egg Priority makes the mistake of trying to answer questions that are irrelevant, right? It proposes a lot of like metaphorical and like, you know, real systemic questions, and then it doesn't do any work to answer them after episode like 8, right? Whereas it spends a lot of time trying to answer logistical questions about the like way the world works, which you don't need. And this goes for a lot of fiction. A lot of fiction does not need to do as much explaining as it does.
Yeah.
Agreed. Well, I think we're at the point where really we just need to wait for that next episode to come out.
Right.
And see what they do.
It's so hard to make a judgment, right?
Yeah. No,
I guess maybe we'll be back in July to say, hey, everything got resolved. Don't bet on it.
Don't bet on that.
I mean, I really want to come back in July and be like, yeah, they knocked it out of the park. They actually fixed it.
It's amazing.
But I don't expect to be able to.
I think our best case scenario is they didn't make it worse.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, okay. So we gotta stop. So thanks so much, everybody, for joining us for Screen Scouts today. Before we head out, we want to give our lovely guest a chance to let folks know about where to find their things. So where can they find your stuff?
Hello. My name is Josh, or Soup, as I go on the internet colloquially. You can find me on all the places at Literal Soup. I do some Twitch streams sometimes every Saturday. I do an Ace Attorney stream with my podcast co-host. And speaking of, I have a podcast called the Absolute Territory Podcast, where we discuss what we like to refer to as modern visual culture, which is to say, we mostly talk about anime, and we generally talk about it in like critical thematic terms, you know, like we did on this episode. So if you're interested in that, my podcast co-host Renu is a lovely person. She does all of like the art stuff. It's very nice. You can find us at Absolute Cast or Absolute Territory Cast, wherever you find your podcasts. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for being here and lending us your insights. We appreciate it. All right, for delightful listeners, if you'd like to let us know what you thought, as a reminder, skiffyfanty.com/listener suggestions. Also follow us at Skiffy Fanty on Twitter and Instagram, and subscribe to the newsletter, skiffyfanty.com/newsletter. And if you like what we do, as always, we're on the Patreon place, so go to patreon.com/skiffyandfanty and give us some love on iTunes with a 5-star review. You can find me at Sean Duke on Twitter, seanduke.net, or I'm also on Patreon at patreon.com/thejoyfactory.
You can find me, Brandon O'Brien, at The Rising Tides on Twitter, brandonobrien.space, and on Speculate, which is at speculatesf.com, where I am currently GMing The Case of the Cinded Seal, a Blades in the Dark actual play, which also stars Iori.
Yes, and you can find me at Iori Kusano on Twitter and at kusanoiori.com.
Awesome. All right, now I gotta make it awkward, but also not do something offensive given the content of this particular show. So I will just note that if I am going to have one of those little pendants with an animal come out of it, it is 100% going to be a very large snake. And I'm going to name him Bubbles.
For once, not actually the most awkward thing that you could have said, actually.
I feel like I kind of had to go the opposite direction because this episode has some pretty heavy themes. So maybe go lightly just kind of like general off the regular beaten path, but not too far off.
Appreciated. And with that, this is Skiffy and Fanti Screen Scouts signing off.
Awkward ending and scene. If you want to support this show, you can go to patreon.com/skiffyandfanti or skiffyandfanti.com, our website, where you can get access to all of our fancy things. Our music comes from Holy Mole. You can support him and his work at patreon.com/holymole. Thank you for listening.